okay? So, and the as you all know, the theme of this time together is Everyday Mind is the Way. And we came up with that because some of you have said to me that you really like the way that during this time you can come together with others for formal practice and then go back to your daily lives. And the in and out of that, or the back and forth, or the interface of those two aspects of our training and practice, you know, was expressed to me that that was valuable to you. And so I thought, well, let's talk about training in everyday life, but we decided that was too boring. And I shifted it. I thought of everyday mind is the way, partly because I came across that saying, that Zen teaching, long before it ever occurred to me or had any thought that I would ever be dedicating my life to Zen practice. And it was one of those things that sort of hits you like an arrow. It's like, yes, and something in you knows what it's talking about and that it's important and what it means, even though coming to know what it means is a lifetime's work, right? And so it has special meaning for me, that phrase, or the teaching that is closely related to it. And they're sometimes used interchangeably, and they're sometimes translated from the same Chinese characters. This very mind of ours is Buddha. So everyday mind is the way, and this very mind of ours is Buddha. So I want to talk about those two teachings tonight. And I want to ask first, did anybody, by any chance, listen to Reverend Master Dai Zui's talk, Everyday Mind is the Way? Pam did? Okay. Nice. Jim did?
I've started it.
You started it. Okay. I just want to know who's familiar with what, because he gave a talk on this very topic. And I have to say that in the course of doing the readings that we could have done, you know, for, I mean, that I suggested and that you suggested, you know, because you all brought up the Katagiri Roshi book, I just thought, this is so lovely. What more is there to say, you know? The readings are just wonderful. So I guess, you know, I'm not sure there's more to say, and yet I'll probably manage to talk too long, as I usually do. I just was really grateful for those readings. It also occurred to me, for those of us who were together 2 Januaries ago when we did the ox herding pictures, that there's a way in which this everyday mind is the way topic picks up from the 10th ox herding picture. I'm not the only one who that right. occurred to. Okay. So, you know, you have the sequence of the pictures with the fellow looking for his ox as a metaphor for the difficult and intense striving type of training that we have to do that then leads to realization and then leads us back into the marketplace. That last picture is called Returning to the Marketplace with Bliss Bestowing Hands. So we go back out into the world or out into our daily lives offering to help and support beings. And so in a sense, we're picking up from there, though that doesn't mean that this teaching doesn't apply to somebody who's just beginning, though I think most of us are not just beginning, right? The other thing is that when I received my first purple small kesa from my master, what he wrote on the back, and it's not this one, was, this very mind of ours is Buddha. And so that's been a kind of thread for me through my time in my involvement with Buddhism. One of the things that Reverend Master Dai Zui does at the beginning of his talk is he said, you know, he heard this teaching, everyday mind is the way, and he said, what? You know, everyday mind is the problem. It's not the solution. And in a way, that points to the crux of, you know, what is this pointing at? Because my everyday mind's a mess, you know, it's all over the place. I mean, he gives this beautiful description about, you know, how he sings ditties and he thinks about this and that and, you know, of how our minds just are, you know how they are. You've all sat in meditation, you all lived your lives. And it hardly seems like enlightenment, right? So I want, but what, you know, what part of what makes it hard to take this kind of teaching, at least for me, and to talk about it and to come to some sense of what's being pointed at, is that it's really about non-duality. That's the fundamental thing here. And how do you put that into words, and how do you talk about it? So there are a couple of things I just want to kind of headline or highlight right at the beginning as context. I'm not going to talk about what I'm about to say. I just want them to be kind of context for what we are talking about, because what we're talking about is so hard to talk about. And the first thing is that there are never two. There are never two things. And there is never just one. Okay? So there are never two, and there is never just one. The third position. No, I don't want to go there right now. And I also wanted to find some words to bring to the word non-duality. Because we talk about non-duality, we have some sense of what that's about, and we talk about the third position. But the words that came to me are what I opened my incense offering with, the dedication. Undivided harmonious functioning. And undivided, of course, is a word that I've borrowed from Reverend Master Daishin Morgan, who uses it in Buddha Recognizes Buddha. And I think it's a very effective word to try to point towards what non-duality is pointing us towards. Undivided, harmonious, functioning, activity. Functioning can sound very technical, but it's really just about the activity of our lives. And that all of this works together harmoniously. And that this is the nature of the universe and of our minds. Okay, so that's just a kind of a great big container or spacious container for what we'll now talk about. I guess part of what I'm trying to point to there is that non-duality doesn't just mean that we're all one. You know, we start out feeling separate, and we're trying to get back to the all is one. But that's not the end of the story, right? And when we come to that sense of oneness, we recognize that we're not separate. We come to understand, we actually experience our interconnectedness and our interpermeatedness. And I sometimes wonder what it would be like if we recognized that from the beginning. We didn't have to go through the sense of separation and the attempt to heal it. But I think that it's important to be aware of that interconnectedness and interpermeability, the way that we interpenetrate each other, and notice that this is about inclusivity, that nothing is left out. You can't take any piece off the web of the universe's harmonious functioning, undivided harmonious functioning. And a little political aside, I think it's interesting that inclusivity is kind of a politically correct buzzword these days, you know? Something we're all looking towards. Okay, so Soku Shin Zei Butsu. Shoku Shin Zei Butsu is the Japanese title of the chapter in Dogen Shobogenzo, which is on this topic of this very mind of ours is Buddha, is how he talks about it. Okay. And as I said earlier, that is sometimes translated everyday mind is the way, and sometimes translated as this very mind is of ours is Buddha. Or everyday or ordinary mind is the way or the path. Okay, so there are a number of permutations in the translation. Sometimes it's translated as mind here and now is Buddha. And it can sometimes feel like you're translating two completely different texts when you come up with those kinds of variations. But think of everyday, ordinary, and this very mind as being equivalent, and Buddha and the way, or the Tao, or the path being equivalent. Okay. Soku shin zeibutsu. Soku means this very, here and now, or every day. Okay. Shin is that word that we can't translate, that we often translate as mind, but also means heart. And sometimes I just think it means our whole being. How could it exclude the body, you know, which is also tangled up in there. Ze means is, but tenses are interesting in those pictorial languages, so it can also include the past and the future. So it may not just be right now, it may be always, you know, or, you know, however you want to put that. And then Butsu, of course. Butsu is Buddha or the way. Now, I want to give you a little historical context, because according to Red Pine, or Bill Porter, who translated Bodhidharma's work. Do we all know who Bodhidharma is? Okay. It's really interesting. One thing about Bodhidharma is that there are now scholars who argue that he never existed. And the writings that are attributed to him are in this little book that was translated by Red Pine quite a while ago, actually. And some of them are, it's not clear that they're attributable to Bodhidharma, but then there's also the issue of maybe he never existed. And Red Pine asks this question. He says, why is Bodhidharma so darn important to us when we know almost nothing? You know, he kind of outlines what he can of Bodhidharma's life. And he said, if this is all we know about this guy, why is he so important to us in Soto Zen? And he says that it's because Bodhidharma really initiated a shift in what Zen was all about. While others viewed Zen as purification of the mind or as a stage on the way to Buddhahood, Bodhidharma equated Zen with Buddhahood and Buddhahood with the mind, the everyday mind. That's what Bill Porter says about Bodhidharma. And I think that's really interesting, that this all kind of goes back to Bodhidharma, maybe began with Bodhidharma, though of course the history isn't that simple or that neat. And Bodhidharma himself wrote in the Bloodstream Sermon that he says, somebody's asking him, what do you mean by mind? And Bodhidharma says, this mind is the Buddha. He says, through endless kalpas without beginning, whatever you do, wherever you are, that's your real mind. That's your real Buddha. This mind is the Buddha says the same thing. Beyond this mind, you'll never find another Buddha. To search for enlightenment or nirvana beyond this mind is impossible. So there, we're done. But I love that. You chuckled, Andrea. Beyond this mind, you'll never find another Buddha. You know, where else are you going to look? So I think that gives us a bit of a context for this. In a sense, it started back there with Bodhidharma. And this is the shift in Buddhist teaching that actually initiated Zen, the Zen lineage. And that's our lineage, right? Those are the teachings that come down specifically to us through Reverend Master Ji. Now, there are a number of koan stories about this that you may be aware of or not. Reverend Master Daizui gives several examples, actually, in his talk. But the initial koan story, I'm going to give you it pretty much the way that he, from the translation he used. So We're back in the 8th century, right? Okay, and Matsu, who's a very famous Zen master, also known as Basu, his disciple is Nansen, whose disciple is Joshu, okay? So Joshu asks Nansen, his teacher, what is the way, with a capital W? And to me, again, Reverend Master Daizuri says this really well, but to me it's just a great question. You know, you come to Buddhism and it speaks to you and you get all excited and you say, how do I do this? You know, and what is this all about? And how do I get enlightened? And what is the way? You know, I mean, that's exactly how I was. And you're all excited and thrilled and you want to devote every minute to this great thing, you know. So tell me what to do. And Nansen responds, the everyday mind is the way, or this very mind is Buddha. And Joshu says, well then, okay, should we try to get it? And Nansen says, as soon as you try, you miss it. And again, it's just wonderful because, of course, Nansen gives Joshu the answer, and then Joshu wants to know how can I do this, you know? And he says, well, if you try, you're not going to get it. And of course, you can imagine. I mean, we've probably all been through a process like this. Joshu's frustration. Well, if I can't try, then how am I going to get it? How do you know without trying? He asks. And Nansen says, the way is beyond both knowing and not knowing. Knowing is false perception. Not knowing is false awareness. When one attains to the way, you know, part of what's being said there is that this is beyond conceptual thought. You can't know it with your usual everyday normal concepts, okay? When one attains to the way, it is certain that one will see it, with a capital I, as clearly as one sees the vastness of the universe. And to me, that's just it. You will see it as clearly as one sees the vastness of the universe. And the vastness of the universe is the everyday mind, right? So then what's the point of discussing this, or what's the point of worrying about it? And of course, at that moment, Joshu is enlightened. Because, you know, all koan stories end with enlightenment. And I did come across somebody who translated this, and at the end, Joshu had a profound insight. They didn't say he was enlightened. Yeah. I thought that was an interesting, yeah, anyway. Okay, so all of this is, in a way, saying, stop asking questions and just get on with it, you know. And it reminds me of Reverend Master Jiyu going to Japan, again, all psyched up to train really hard. And what did she say? She wanted the perfection of Zen. And Koho Zenji, her teacher, said, just live. And she thought, just live? I came all the way to Japan at great expense, you know, and great inconvenience, and I'm supposed to just live? I could have done that at home, you know. And so, in a sense, to me, that's what Nansen is saying to Joshu. But he's also pointing out, you know, we have this capacity to grasp the vastness of the universe. And that ability is our everyday mind, and it's also the Buddha mind. So that's a beginning to me of a sense of what this is all about. Now, I want to talk a little bit about these various ways of putting this and what they're pointing to, okay? So everyday mind is the way, or ordinary mind is the path, or ordinary mind is the way, to me, points to the path aspect of training, that there is a path or a way, and we're following it. And we start out with the mind stained, and we're trying to get to the mind pure, as we walk this path. Or from impurity to purity, or from the afflicted states to unafflicted states, or from gross coarseness to enlightenment. Something like that. You know, there's some kind of bad place we're starting and some wonderful place we can get to if we put in the effort, which Nansen said, just forget about that, you know. Okay, so we've got this cruddy mind or this ordinary mind, And our everyday life and our everyday experience becomes the grist for the mill that we use to transmute that mind from the ordinary crud to the enlightenment that we think we're seeking, this goal that we hold before ourselves. And I think that's really important because it points to, you know, the ordinariness of our daily life is exactly the walking of the path, and how we live that ordinariness and how we use it and how we train with it, right? And we all talk about this a lot and do it all the time. I mean, this is our practice, in effect, is living our ordinary daily life and using it to train ourselves and to gradually convert, what are those three things? Desire, anger, and delusion into compassion, love, and wisdom. Greed, hatred, and delusion into compassion, love, and wisdom, right? In a sense, this is the process of sanctifying the mundane. You know, we take that. If you take an ordinary garden shovel and you treat it like a Buddha, you've sanctified the mundane. And that doesn't involve putting it on the altar and bowing down and offering incense. You know, it means taking care of the shovel, respecting it, using it mindfully, using it carefully. So the way that we can transform a shovel into a Buddha is the same way that we sanctify the mundane or transform our ordinary daily life into that which is the Buddha mind. Okay? In which case everything becomes sacred, right? So, as I said, sometimes this is translated as ordinary mind instead of everyday mind. And this refers to the usual normal mind that we have, and also, and this is interesting to me, also to the mind before there is discrimination. Okay? So the mind before discrimination arises. To me, this might be, I think, what in our order we sometimes refer to as natural thought as opposed to deliberate thought. Okay. It also reminds me of, if you're familiar with Bonnke's book, The Unborn, Bonnke talks about when you're just doing the laundry or you're just knitting or you're just cooking, that's the Buddha mind. But then we add all kinds of things to it and make it very complicated, and we've lost the Buddha mind. So this sense of just doing these simple daily activities is the ordinary mind, which is also the Buddha mind. You know, and that's where, actually, where that chopping wood, carrying water thing comes from. And the way that it's put in this book, let's see if I can get myself to the right place. This is Ordinary Mind is the Way by Mario Posesky. I told you this book is actually in some ways quite extraordinary and quite scholarly, so it's a bit of work to get through it, but it can at times be really worth it. He writes, "What do I mean by ordinary mind?" Well, wait, let me, I'm going to back up what, he begins by saying that ordinary mind is pointing out that the realization of truth is to be found within the context of everyday life, okay? In the mind of each person. The notion of ordinary mind points out the proximity and all-pervasiveness of reality. This reminds me actually of the book Most Intimate, of intimacy, you know, that when we're, and also of Joko Beck, you know, when we're right with our lives and what we're doing, we're intimate with them. And that's our reality. You know, there isn't another reality. There isn't, you know, somewhere else to go. So that cultivation of that kind of intimacy points directly to reality. And then he continues on and he says something that actually speaks of it in a quite different way. What do I, and this is Matsu actually, nonsense teacher. What do I mean by ordinary mind? It is a mind that is devoid of contrived activity and is without notions of right and wrong, grasping and rejecting terminable and permanent, worldly and holy. So this is pointing to that ordinary mind is the mind before discrimination, right? And then Posesky, the writer of this book, goes on to say that one of Matsu's key points is that such a mental state can be perfected within the context of everyday life. So on the one hand, this is about our training in everyday life. And then he goes on to say, the state of ordinary mind is the goal of practice, and it denotes a method of cultivation which involves single-minded endeavor to maintain a detached state of non-dual awareness. So that's another way of saying the mind before discrimination arises, a detached state of non-dual awareness before we start separating things, before we start creating things, before we start making, you know, manufacturing. All the things. Yeah, okay. Okay, so there's two different things going on here at once, right? On the one hand, ordinary mind, everyday mind is everyday, is the everyday stuff of our lives. And on the other hand, it's this mind before discrimination arises, okay? So it's a little bit complex in that way. This is not a straight line that we're talking about here, or, you know, a simple, okay? And I think what's important here is to remember that the real crux of our practice, where the rubber hits the road, the real work, is not in the sublime meditative states or the great experiences. It's in how we respond to each moment of our daily lives, no matter how trivial or mundane they are. It's not so much what we're doing, but how we're doing it. Okay? Now, that translation that I mentioned of this mind here and now is Buddha. Did I mention that? That's one way this is sometimes translated. And that emphasizes the word soku, this very here and now, every day. This mind here and now is Buddha, to me, is pointing to the here and now reality. You know, reality is right here. I've already touched on this. Reality is Buddha. Buddha is reality. You know, there isn't a Buddha other than what we're living in the midst of right now. Okay? So if you don't have the Buddha mind, where are you going to go to find a Buddha? This is a line from the Platform Sutra that one of our congregation members put into a song and sang for us. And so I spent a number of months of my life at the Abbey going around singing, if you don't have the Buddha mind, where are you going to go to find a Buddha? And it's really something to think about, you know. We're always looking somewhere else for it. We think it's something other than our own mind, something other than our own lives. So I think it can be helpful. Where are you going to go to find a Buddha? Now, the translation, this very mind of ours is Buddha, which is slightly different. This very mind of ours is Buddha, is pointing to not this path aspect that I see in everyday mind is the way, but we are already Buddha. Right here, right now, we are already Buddha. And it's pointing to that. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to get. It's the goalless aspect of practice, right? Because where are you going to go to find a Buddha? What other mind have you got? You know, there's this, for those of you who are, there's a Chinese saga called Monkey that is a kind of a metaphor for Buddhist practice. that when I was first at the Abbey, it was one of the few things that was there to read. And there's a place in there, monkey, you know, monkey's a metaphor for the scattered, crazy mind, right? And he's on a journey to get the Buddhist scriptures. And at one point, he gains some spiritual powers, and he's able to go anywhere in the universe in an instant. And he thinks this is pretty cool. But I probably won't get this story right, so some of you may know it better than I do. And he somehow, I think, gets into trouble, and the Buddha rescues him. So he's on the Buddha's hand. And somehow the Buddha isn't going to let him off his hand. And monkey's saying, well, I can get off your hand. That's easy. You know, I just can walk over here and I'm off your hand. So monkey walks over there and he's still on the Buddha's hand. And so he thinks, oh, wow, okay. So he shoots himself a little further out, you know, and a little faster. And he's still on the Buddha's hand. And so he tries again and he goes further and faster and he's still on the Buddha's hand. And then, you know, he makes a supreme effort to throw himself out to the edge of the universe in a split second, and he does it, and he's still on the Buddha's hand. You know, and you could imagine this Buddha sort of saying, see, I told you, you know. Nah, 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 you can't get off my hand. But the point is that we can't get off the Buddha's hand. You know, we can't get off the Buddha's hand. There's nowhere else to go. You know, we are already Buddha, and it points really to the fundamental nature of our minds. First of all, you know, there's nowhere else to go. This mind, the fundamental nature of our mind is clear, bright, pure awareness, right? And it has no boundaries and it has no limits. It's as big as the universe. So you can't get out of it, and it includes everything. So it's completely inclusive, right? So we have this mind even when there are clouds obscuring the sky, even when we're caught in greed, delusion, afflictive emotions, criticism, judgments, and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's kind of like asking that question, when have we ever not been training? You know, if you think about it, you were training even before you came to Buddhist practice. So, the mind of pure, bright, clear, unobstructed awareness. This is the original fundamental nature of our minds, and it's always there, and we've always got it, right? Okay. In fact, this guy, Pasesky, talks about this too. And I'll read you just a little. This teaching propounds that all sentient beings without exception have the empty, tranquil, true mind. From time without beginning, it is the intrinsically pure, effulgent, unobstructed, clear and bright, ever-present awareness. Boy, that sounds pretty great, doesn't it? I'll take that. Ordinary people are supposedly unaware of the true mind's sublime actuality because they are caught up in webs of attachments, desires, and views. Accordingly, they fail to see that the deluded thoughts that obscure the true mind are little more than adventitious defilements. All activities performed in the course of everyday life are functions of the Buddha nature, which constitutes the real nature or essence of each person. All of you, and this is Matsu again talking to whoever he's talking to, all of you should believe that your mind is Buddha, that this mind is identical with Buddha. Outside of mind, there is no other Buddha. Outside of Buddha, there is no other mind. So this is just, in a sense, repeating or reinforcing what I've been saying. And, you know, one of the ways I personally think about it, this is, if you think about yourself, if you're within the meditative mind, you know, you're noticing what your mind is getting up to, you might notice, say, that you're criticizing somebody, that there's a judgment there. There is something in us that is bigger than that judgment. And from the point of view of meditation, we notice the criticism, and there's something bigger noticing the criticism. And then we think, oh, I shouldn't have criticized. That's a defilement, or, you know, that's bad. I'm not supposed to do that. I'm a Buddhist. That reaction to our initial criticism, there's a mind or a heart or a something, a spaciousness that's bigger than that criticism, and then our criticism of ourself criticizing, you know. And then we say, oh, I could put this all down, and we put it down, and there's something bigger within which that is contained, and it's that bigger thing, that biggerness, that I think of as this Buddha mind that we all have, that encompasses our everyday life and way of doing things. So that something bigger is the Buddha mind, and it's always there, no matter what's happening. Okay, so Dogen in the Shobo Genzo, and you know, translates this as "your very mind is Buddha," and he says, I'm going to just give you one line from him to keep it brief, but he says, he translates it, mind here and now is Buddha. He says, now you know clearly what is called mind is the great earth with its mountains and rivers. It is the sun, the moon, and the stars. So, you know, Dogen to me is one of the greatest mystics that ever lived. And he's always trying to point to what he understands by making everything else, if I can put it that way. Now you know clearly what is called mind is the great earth with its mountains and rivers, and it's nothing other than the magnificence of this planet we live on, in effect. Okay? And I don't think we can rationally understand that, but I think we can sense what he's pointing to. And I think the trap here, is that it's too easy to take something like this and fall into the opposites. And that's why I pointed to non-duality at the beginning, you know, to point to the need to hold this within something bigger than setting up the opposites that instantly occur to us when we start to talk about something like this very mind is Buddha. And, you know, I think that... Well, you know, the Buddha was enlightened together with all living beings. We keep trying to separate things. We separate Buddhas and living things. We separate everyday mind in the way. We put a gap. That's a category Roshi would use that word. We put a gap between ourselves and others, and then we have to close the gap. Because in effect, there is no gap there to begin with, right? So, you know what? Nonsense trying to tell Joshu in that koan at the beginning is we're trying to grasp empty space, and you can't grasp empty space. Now, I don't want to keep talking too much longer, but I'll just draw your attention to, there are other koan stories related to this that we could talk about some other time if we want to, but don't have to. So Matsu teaches that this very mind of ours is Buddha, but then he teaches later that this very mind isn't Buddha, and it's not mind or Buddha. And then he says, it's not a thing. And then he says, I teach this very mind of ours is Buddha in order to stop babies from crying. In effect, he's saying, I'm giving my monks a rattle to play with so they'll stop. So anyway, that's all a bit of an aside, but this has a very rich and convoluted kind of history to it that can be interesting when you start looking at it. So when we are meditating, we're not clinging, right? We're letting go, we're not discriminating, we're just sitting. This adage, everyday mind is the way, is just a way of describing our meditation practice. Okay, this just sitting and letting go of everything. And Zen, of course, is all about bringing meditation to all of our life, not just on the cushion, but to everything we do. So we're meditating all the time, right? So all day long, as we're letting go, we're meditating, and our mind is being Buddha. That's what this is pointing to. It also means that our practice is nothing special and doesn't require expensive equipment or hard to cultivate skills. It's always right here, right now, with us. But to me, this brings me to the question of why does it matter to us? And I think the answer is in what I just said, that our practice isn't anything special, and it is something that we're doing all the time, or can do all the time. You know, we can cultivate this all the time. It's always right here for us. And it's in the minutest, most mundane, most unimportant thing that we do. And that, you know, it kind of cuts through any hierarchy of what's valuable and what isn't valuable. And makes every moment that we have, in effect, special and precious. The other thing I think that it does is it gives us an avenue into trust. It really means that we can trust things as they are, exactly as they are. And in a difficult to live in world, that can seem very counterintuitive. But I think this teaching means that we can relax into things as they are. We can just relax into what is, this moment that we're in right now, even when it's horrifying, with a modicum of acceptance and a modicum of clear seeing. And I think that relaxing, acceptance, and clear seeing are the trust. And that when we rely on those things, we can actually live at peace in situations that are very painful, very difficult, as well as situations that aren't. So I think that's part of the gift of this teaching to us. Now I want to end with a little metaphor or analogy. Let's say you have a vase, a nicely shaped vase. Say it's made out of really wonderful, that wonderful Chinese white porcelain, you know, with a beautiful blue painting on it. The space inside the vase is exactly the same as the space outside the vase. And if you smash the vase, it's just one space. And that's what our very mind being Buddha is.